Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
It's a dream, so believe it. Now get ready to receive it. There is a peaceful solution. It's called a peace revolution.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast for higher education. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at Tragedy and Hope is presented without corporate sponsorship and provided to you commercial-free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the members of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts at tragedyandhope.com. I also encourage you to check into the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. In follow-up to episode 18, specifically as to how the lecture ends, there was a question posed in the Peace Revolution group on the Tragedy and Hope community. Therein, several members responded to the inquiry, and I thought that all of the responses added some much-needed context on the topic. The intention of presenting Monteith's lecture discussing Carol Quigley's 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was to point out A, the metaphor brought forth in the form of his story of the murder on the Orient Express, specifically related to the orgies of evidence created by multiple secret societies when they practice chaos sorcery. Ironically enough, Jan Irvin recently interviewed someone who has firsthand knowledge of the topic and question posed in the Tragedy and Hope community. And the first segment of this episode will contain an excerpt from Gnostic Media Podcast number 105, with Mark Passio, providing some unique and empowering insights into Monteith's claims. For the record, Dr. Monteith was addressing the audience of The Prophecy Club, a Christian forum for presenting research for discussion. Therein, one realizes that due to the dogmatic beliefs of his direct audience, Dr. Monteith fails to provide a defined nomenclature for what he refers to as Luciferian influences in the world. Outside the limitations of Christian dogma, one might recognize what he refers to be Luciferian to be a trademark pattern of destruction, greed, human sacrifice, ego worship, and overall selfishness at the cost of the lives of others. Juxtaposed to the perspective expressed by Dr. Monteith, I chose to include this excerpt from Jan's podcast episode 105 because Mark Passio succinctly illustrates a selection of the most common forms of consciousness suppression, presenting 14 layers of thought control most prevalent and in widest use today. And it's through understanding these different devices that one comes to be free of them. And when you hear them for yourself, you'll realize that you're likely already well-versed with each of them individually, but like many of us, have failed to see how they can be woven into a pattern of manipulating individuals as well as the massive public consciousness. And therein, you'll have the beginnings of your own self-immunity to the predators who seek to suppress consciousness and life itself. The second section of this episode features James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com and Paul Verge of DivergentFilms.com in discussion with Bob Tuscan of Truth Be Told Radio. And their discussion helps to outline some of the solutions, which include learning for ourselves, learning to communicate with compassion and empathy, and learning how to take peaceful, meaningful, and constructive action in the face of a status quo which is predominantly based on greed, human sacrifice, ego worship, and overall selfishness. This is episode 19, Autodidactic Self-Liberation, Outgrowing Our Misperceptions. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
At a young age, I started realizing that the religion that I had been indoctrinated into, which was Christianity, specifically Catholicism, modern organized Catholicism, was fraudulent and was based on essentially a form of control through telling people myths that really weren't accurate or true and getting them to accept dogmatic belief systems based upon those myths. I understood that aspect of organized religion. Yet I did not yet understand any of the esoteric sides of it, namely how it was based upon astrotheology. Had I had the knowledge of astrotheology, maybe my life would have taken a very different course in my past. What my hatred for religion upon understanding how it was based upon lies, what that hatred, the route that that hatred took me down was to attempt to find something that was the complete antithesis of that religion. So in doing so, I got involved in Satanism. I wanted to find that whatever was the complete opposite of what I had been lied to about, and that hatred fueled that, the hatred of being lied to, that developed as a result of knowing that I was lied to. So what I eventually stumbled across was LaVey's Satanic Bible, Anton LaVey, high priest, former high priest of the Church of Satan in San Francisco. LaVey, some people think, is like a charlatan or a carny type individual, but let me assure people that the brand of Satanism that he teaches and puts out there is actually the ideology of the elite, is actually the ideology of the psychopaths that are really running the show here and are, you know, running all of the modern depraved and immoral institutions that have basically risen up and taken the types of draconian control that they have and that they now have over just about every aspect of our life, unfortunately. Not to say that LaVey was any kind of a really higher up in that pecking order whatsoever. As a matter of fact, learning what his real role was later, I realized he was simply a lapdog for these much, much higher level dark occultists and pretty much did their bidding. However, basically, to go back to my background in this, the ideology appealed to me then because of my low level of consciousness. I wanted influence over others. I wanted power. I wanted to have as much as possible at anyone else's expense. That was really the mindset that I existed in back in my youth. I wasn't a very good person. I wasn't a very nice person. I was a selfish person, and I'm man enough to admit that now. My level of consciousness was quite low. I was probably easily influenced by appeals to my base instincts. And that is what Satanism really held as a promise. And it's a system that a lot of people really don't understand how it works, that it basically appeals to those low-level base instincts in people. And it's looking for intelligent, well-articulated people. It's looking for people who don't have strong family connections. And there's deep psychological profiles that are actually worked up on beginning initiates to this who show promise and who show the types of tendencies or personality traits that they are actually looking for to then filtrate upward into the higher orders of the system. And then from my understanding, they begin to filter those people who they consider psychopathic into think tank organizations and other higher level occult organizations that are connected in these satanic networks. And that is all the Church of Satan, which is what I eventually became a priest in. I was actually appointed a priest in the Church of Satan by Anton LaVey himself while he was still alive, actually only about 3 years prior to his death, I believe it was. And they're looking for people with these specific personality traits that they can then groom to bring up higher into that pecking order of dark occultism. And I went as far as becoming a member of the priesthood of the Church of Satan. I had ties to the Temple of Set, to the Order of the Evil Eye, to other dark occult orders in the Pennsylvania region and in the region around the Philadelphia area, which is where I'm from. And once I started really to understand that it was something that was really a very controlled hierarchical thing that was controlled by top level, rich, super, I'm talking about the super rich elitists, not people who are just well to do in you know, your average society in a city, let's say. I'm talking about people who are at the top of institutionalized bodies, top level banking, top level military, top level religion, etc. When I started understanding who was really involved at these higher levels, I began to realize this was all about control. Not just control of people outside of these orders, but control of their own membership. And it's a form of mind control. You know, it's again, appealing to base instincts for some sort of a reward if you fall in line with an agenda is a form of mind control. And when I started to understand that, I guess you could say conscience began to awaken in me. And I realized I'm on the wrong path in life here. I'm helping really depraved, truly psychopathic individuals enact an agenda that I am not really even fully privy to or aware of. And therefore, I started reversing my course and started to back out of it slowly but surely until I learned so much about really what was going on and the interconnectedness of these different orders that I started to speak out on it and then help to explain to people what their actual methodologies were in controlling the human mind and how multifaceted those methodologies are, and then to propose solutions to coming out of that that level of mind control, which really is enacted in mass. It's through the media, it's through the education system, it's through just about every aspect of our lives, when it comes to health and food, anything we read or watch or take into ourselves in any way. And that's what I've been doing ever since, you know, trying to basically turn around from the former dark ways that I lived for many years probably from my teens into my late 20s, and, you know, finally beginning to come out of that in my late 20s until, you know, the modern day when I've been doing the type of work that I've been doing now for probably about I guess since about 2006, so, you know, going on 5 years now.
What are the mind control methodologies?
Well, there's tons of them, actually. I, in my presentation, which I called What on Earth is Happening, and that's the name of my website, whatonearthishappening.com, and I have a radio show also called that, which I do every Tuesday night. I actually outlined 14 different methodologies of mind control. And there are many more. It's not in any way to say that these are the only 14. They're the 14 that I identified as probably being the most necessary to understand, because I think they're the most influential over the control of mass consciousness. So I'll list them briefly, and if you want to talk about anyone in particular, we can jump into that in detail. But here's the list that I have come up with. And again, is not to say that this is in any way complete or comprehensive. They're the ones I consider the most important. The first is obfuscation, which is just basic confusion of one thing for another. Okay, it's like a smoke and mirrors game, so to speak. The second is worldview poisoning, which is basically conditioning the way that people view human nature and their own self-value. Okay. The third is the exploitation of primal fears. There are really ancient primal fears that date back to human antiquity that are really nested into the subconscious mind because of the ways our ancestors lived and some of the fears that they developed in our ancient past, you know, as a species. And those fears are exploited in very subtle ways. So the exploitation of primal fears was number three. Number four is a big one, and it's one that a lot of people do know about to some extent, and it's the divide and conquer strategy, which is basically highlighting any perceived differences between people and then exploiting those differences to a point where you can create infighting between different groups of people in order to weaken people as a whole, and then they're easier to come in and control and eventually conquer. The fifth method is the indoctrination of what we call the education system in this country, which is a left-brain form of indoctrination and outcome-based education that was championed by the communists during the Bolshevik Revolution and then eventually adapted by the Nazis as part of what was called mastery learning. And that is what really comes down to us in the modern high school, in the modern grade school, high school, and university education system, in a system of left brain indoctrination techniques. So that's number five. Number six was controlled opposition, which is basic dialectics, dialectical mechanics, or what some people might refer to as Hegelianism. This is basically creating conflict that you already have an outcome management system for. You have an outcome management system for said conflict. So you're going to create the conflict and wait for a type of a reaction to that conflict, which is usually a chaotic one or one that demands a resolution to that conflict. Then you're going to step forward as the resolver of said conflict. And this is done in the political system. It's done through the media. It's done through religion. It's basically artificial conflict resolution. That's what controlled opposition or dialectics is all about. The seventh method is one that everybody is aware of, yet few people have any sort of formal remedies for, and that's the monetary system or the financial system of control, which is debt-based, fiat currency-based, fractional reserve banking, this system of illusion that has been built up that we call money, which never has been real, isn't real now, never will be real, yet people believe in it as if it's a religion or a god, you know, that controls every aspect of their life and that they could never live without. This is one of the biggest monolithic aspects of the control system, and yet it's the one that people seem to be the most powerless to come out of, largely because it is entirely constructural in the mind. It exists purely in the mind, and the value of so-called money in today's world is only the value that we ascribe to it through our belief in it. So that's mind control method number seven that I cover. Number eight is the control of the mass media. So if you can control the information that people get to see, hear, read, you basically control their perceptions over what they consider reality. If you limit the scope of what they can take in to their minds and into their awareness, you basically limit the possibilities that they can put forward as far as solutions go, or even limiting their ability to think of anything in a different light. You're limiting the human imagination through controlling what people take into their eyes and ears. So the control of the mass media plays a gigantic role in that. It's human perception management. So that was technique number eight. Technique number nine I call food and medicine in quotation marks, because the attack on the physical aspects of the body, they basically relate to how our brain development goes. And as you affect brain development through what people take into their bodies, through nutrition, you affect thought and consciousness. The old adage, you are what you eat, is quite literally true. These are the building blocks that comprise the physiology and the makeup of our brain, and therefore how the brain functions, and therefore it directly affects human behavior. The same can be said for drugs. Any kind of pharmacopoeia that we take in through pills, medicines, any kind of treatments in the modern medical world, these are all things that actually affect the whole holistic consciousness. And if they can use techniques that are damaging overall to the consciousness, it's another effective form of control through the modern medical system. The tenth method is called the illusion of time. This is a rather abstract one, but it's one that I think is extremely important for people to grasp. Essentially, this is playing on people's seeming inability to live in the true present moment, in the state of true present moment awareness. It's getting people to live in a state of either regret over the past or anxiety over. This is a fear-based technique. Okay, the past does not exist. It's gone.
Anxiety over what? You cut out for just a second.
Anxiety over what has already occurred in the past, or a regret for what has already occurred in the past, or anxiety for what may occur in the future. This takes us out of what is called true present moment awareness, or being in the now, dealing with what is actually before us in the real world, right here and now, and being fully present to take on whatever may be at hand to look at and deal with. And if they can, if our consciousness can be manipulated into always looking at what already happened, that we don't have any control to go back and undo in the past, because that moment in time is over, or constantly worrying about what might be and what may come, okay, it takes away effectiveness from dealing with what the current situation at hand right now actually is, and makes people less effective in dealing with present moment, present day issues and problems. So this one kind of is, again, it's an abstract one. It's one that you have to understand. There is no other moment of time. There is only the now. And what we do in the present will actually determine the quality of our experience in the future. The 11th method is I've kind of coined this little term, I call it the DHR factor. And this is the threefold factor of basically what other people perceive about you, okay? The denial, hassle, ridicule factor, okay? Denial is staying in a state of cognitive dissonance, or the denial of reality, okay? In other words, lying to oneself to make oneself feel good about a situation that isn't necessarily good in any way, just because other people ignore it, okay? I'm going to just stay in this state of ignoring reality, of not actually accepting that which is, but, you know, thinking that things are fine the way that they are. I don't want to rock the boat or anything, because then I might have to deal with the next aspect of this little, nasty trinity here called hassle. Hassle is where other people give you problems for the way, or flack for the way you may think or feel about a situation, or things that you may do differently than them, or, you know, things that you may do that rocks the boat in their system. So people will tend to stay in what is called the hassle-free zone. I don't want all of the uncomfortable aspects of life that may come with standing up for truth or morality, or espousing true human freedom. I would rather stay in the hassle-free zone, because then at least I'll be left alone by other people, and I won't rock the boat to a point where I draw attention to myself. Again, these things are all fear-based. Denial is fear-based. It's fear of actually taking the responsibility to deal with what's happening in the present moment and what's going on around you. Hassle is the fear of what others may do to you if you start doing something different, or start opposing things that you don't aren't morally okay with. Okay, and then the third aspect of this is ridicule. The ridicule factor is you don't want to deal with what other people's perceptions of you may be. You're fearful of what other people may think of you. So that's the 11th technique, the denial, hassle, ridicule factor, heightening those three forms of mental instability, which is what they all really ultimately boil down to, and trying to keep people in that trap of inactivity and not really doing anything to make things better. The 12th, 13th, and 14th, the last three methods, are the ones I tend to spend the most time on and attribute the most importance to, because of how powerful of a hold they can have over the human psyche. Now, of course, the financial system is a really big one, and I don't downplay the significance of that one in all these 14. But I attribute the last three, I call those the big guns. These are the ones that really I feel have the tightest hold and over the human mind, and really are the ones that we need to understand as much, if not better, than all the others if we're really going to come out of this form of control. And the first of these last three is religion. And I know that this is something that you've spent an enormous amount of time and effort and scholarly work exposing. And I talk about religion as a form of binding, because the word religion actually comes from the Latin language, and it means to tie back. Religare is a word that means to tie back. Re means back or again in Latin, and legeo legere is to tie or to bind. So religion is tying back. Now, in a sense, forms of modern day religion are mind control based upon astrotheology. And I know, as your listeners are well aware of, you've done an enormous amount of work exposing astrotheology as it relates to religion and religious traditions. I focus on that in my work as well, and there's a lot of overlap there. And you know, this is a form of binding when it comes to how religion is used. It's giving people an exoteric version of something that was once an esoteric mystery that was related to the self and to consciousness. So if you can get them focusing on the external or the exoteric aspects, you really have them under a form of control, because they're not really looking inward and dealing with the esoteric or the actual deep core of the seed of truth that lies at the heart of really all the religious traditions, what they were ultimately unified about, not what they were divided about and warring over, okay? But so there can be a positive side to the word religion, or what the original essence of religion was intended to be, and that means to rebind to the truth or to natural law, to make a reconnection with self, with higher self. And that is, you know, a positive aspect of the word. It can mean, you know, as with symbolism, words can take on dual meanings depending on how you look at it and what the original intent is. I believe that religion in the modern world has become true binding as a form of mind control that basically binds the left brain or logical hemisphere, the masculine hemisphere of the brain, and puts too much of an overemphasis on the right brain, sacred feminine side of the brain, that leads to actually wanting to be controlled or wanting to be enslaved in a sense, in a form. Government is the opposite of that. It is the binding upon the right brain through left brain masculine control-based modalities of consciousness. So these two forms of control, government and religion, are two sides of the arch that leans against each other for tremendous support. They're two forms of mind control that go to work on the two different hemispheres of the human brain. So that's the 12th method. The 13th one, again, this is one of the what I kind of call the unholy trinity, or the three big guns of mind control, is the use of subversive symbolism that is basically based in ancient sacred symbolism. And this is all over the modern world. It's a language unto itself. It is based in symbols that have been with us from antiquity. It is religious symbolism. It is a symbolism that employs solar symbolism. Of course, this is one of their favorites. Life force symbolism, symbolism that is based upon energy and blood and just in general things that we need for existence and life. And they use these different archetypal energies, these archetypal forms in modern symbolism, whether it be for symbolism for an institution, symbolism for advertising, you name it, police, military, banking institutions, media corporations, stores, every aspect of our life. We are in just completely symbolism is omnipresent. It's everywhere. We're surrounded by it. We're drenched in it practically because people who were attempting to influence people's minds and their behavior patterns and their buying patterns know how powerful of a subconscious psychic influence basic symbols are. And they know that those symbols speak to the human subconscious. And if they understand what those symbols say, the language that they basically speak to the subconscious, they can speak to us without words, wordlessly. And they can embed things subliminally through these symbols that we don't even understand what they're saying. Okay, so it's a wordless form of communication, and an ancient one at that. And this is what I've been spending the bulk of my time recently on my radio show discussing and delving into many different forms of symbolism. And that connects with different occult traditions as well, because occult traditions are laden with symbolism as well. And, you know, as a tie-in to looking into different forms of subversive symbolism as they are used in the modern world through advertising, media, governmental institutions and, networks, etc. I've kind of been doing a crossover into discussing different occult traditions like that really heavily employ symbolism, like Kabbalah, Tarot, Freemasonry, etc. So that's technique number 13 and the final technique that I cover, at least. We could discuss others, but this is, again, these are the out of the 14 that I cover and consider significant. The 14th and final one, many people have given it different names. It's been called problem reaction solution. I like to call this one chaos sorcery. Okay, people have called it chaos magic, but I like the word sorcery in place of magic because I tend to make a distinction between these two forms of influence. I call this chaos sorcery because what this is a mass demonstration, okay, or a public display of the dark aspects of the Hegelian dialectic. Okay, the Hegelian dialectic has two sides to it. It could be used as a weapon. It could be used in a positive sense. But when you look at Hegelianism and dialectical mechanics, and you look at how this concept is employed on mass scales in public daylight, so to speak, right in the light of day, okay, there's this technique that comes up over and over again, and I call it chaos sorcery. Now, what other people have just traditionally referred to this as is false flag terrorism, which I'm sure is a phrase that a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. I tend to make a little bit more of a distinction, because I feel that this is ritual magic that is being used openly in the light of day, regardless of who's doing it. What you're doing is you're creating a chaotic situation in the light of day that you are well aware of that it's being created because you're doing it. And you know that the situation that you're creating is going to elicit an extreme reaction of fear, and it's going to be a chaotic reaction that demands order be brought to that situation as quickly as possible. In doing so, what you're doing is manipulating the human fear-based functions of the brain, which are in the limbic system, and people who think through the limbic system are simply reacting emotionally. They're not really reasoning. They're not in a state that they can reason, because the limbic brain has turned on to a point where it's really has taken over, and they're demanding solutions purely out of emotions. So the person's not in a reasonable state of mind, not in a high level of consciousness. They're in a reactive mode of consciousness, and that creates the perfect opportunity for the manipulator who created this situation in the first place to step in with a predetermined solution. See, controllers, dominators, psychopaths, they want the outcome of the game known before the game has even begun to be played. So that's what this form of chaos sorcery is about. It's about interjecting chaos into a situation, and you know the reaction it's going to cause, and therefore you know what the reaction is going to be like when you step forward and propose the solution. You know that it will be accepted, provided that there is no leap in consciousness or mass understanding of the technique that's being employed, which is why you always have to carry it out in a covert fashion under a cloak of darkness, never in the light of day where it can be seen for what it is. And this technique, sadly, seems to work over and over and over again in human history, and as yet, humanity has not in mass awoken to how this tactic is deployed and used as a method of mass control. And 9/11, of course, was the prime example in the modern in modern times of what I term chaos sorcery, which is the 14th and final method of manipulation. So there's my breakdown, Jan. That's what I've been covering on my show for many, many weeks, and will continue to do so for several more. When I exhaust these methods of mind control, then I will be going into the positive side. Of course, you know, this is the negative aspect, and it's important to know about. Yes, it's negative. Yes, it's you know, really being used as weaponry against us. And no, not many people are fully aware of all of these techniques, but that's the whole point. We need to make them aware of them by speaking them and helping people to understand them and laying them out in a logical progression so that people can become streetwise to them, you might say, so that when they are brought out, they can see them for what they are. They can see the truth of these techniques for what they are and how they are used to manipulate people and basically used as a form of mind control.
We're joined with our friend James Evan Pilato, or Pilato, as it's pronounced. Welcome, James, to the Intel Hub Radio Show. How are you tonight?
Doing well. Thanks so much. It's my pleasure to be on.
And why don't you go ahead and tell listeners that have been living under a rock about all your sites, all your wonderful shows with James Corbett, all the great stuff. Tell the listeners.
The main flagship site is MediaMonarchy.com, and the website's been up for going on 6 years, and I've been doing the weekly radio version for going on 5 years. And as the site and show slowly kind of organically grew and got bigger, I started to expand out and start other sites to focus on more specific areas. For example, foodworldorder.com gets into, of course, the food, eugenics, GMO agenda, and more. And I also have cyberspacewar.com that gets into, of course, cyberspace and technology, and also even the, you know, events beyond our planet, you know, with Solar Max 2012 and all of these sort of earth changes. So those are the things we go over there. And I even launched a new site a few weeks ago called holyhexes.com that goes over the occult and religion in society.
All cool stuff. And let's not forget, you are a contributor at Tragedy and Hope, as well as our next guest, Paul DeVergen, James Corbett, Jan Irvin, all these great people we're working with. And that's all at Tragedy and Hope, a site really focused on, you know, education and the trivium, all good stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And earlier today, I taped this week's episode of New World Next Week that I do with, like you said, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. I can give you a quick sneak preview because, again, you know, I'm so thankful to be connected to all kinds of great folks. You know, they say you should always surround yourself with people smarter than you.
Yeah.
I think by being connected to folks like James Corbett and Richard Grove and Paul Verge, I think I've successfully done that. But, you know, James Corbett, he does the lion's share of the production on the New World Next Week videos. Uh-huh. I mean, I basically, you know, show up on Skype at our predetermined time and have the stories that we want to cover. But he does all the video editing and all that fantastic stuff. So, again, it's just a blessing to be connected to him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's kind of like our executive producer Alex Thomas here behind the scenes, you know,
mm-hmm.
making it easy for us talking heads to get out there and do this stuff. And my co-host Shepard Ambella is feeling a little bit under the weather, but he's definitely a big fan of yours. And I wanted to mention that he'll be listening to this. So, Shep, we love you, buddy. Feel better. I know you're feeling a little under the weather. You wanted to be here. But let's get to some of the topics you cover. And there's so many different things going on. Yesterday on the program, we had Cassandra Anderson from MorphCity.com. She works with G. Edward Griffin and has been working on this story about this genetically modified stewardship agreement, the MTSA, as it was called yesterday on the show. And that's not the TSA we were talking about last segment, folks. There's this real issue with seeds and food. You have a website dedicated to this topic, or film rather, dedicated to this topic. Henry Kissinger, of course, quoted in saying that if you want to control the people, you really can control them through their food supply. That's the most important way to control them. What's the next step in this endgame of our food control between the toxins? I'm sure we can go on and on. So let's just jump right into it. What's your take?
You know, I would love to think that as far as even using the term endgame, I'm hopeful in thinking that the endgame is for the elites. And just as, you know, we to pull from our regular mythology, just like Princess Leia says in Star Wars, that Darth Vader, you know, the tighter you make your fist, the more people and planets and communities are going to slip beyond your control. I would like to think that as things are digressing, but there's a mass amount of people waking up and at least, if not becoming 100% fully aware of what's going on, and again, I wouldn't even put myself in that camp doing this and being involved in alternative media is, you know, first and foremost educational for myself and then to try and share that with folks. But I work at a grocery store here in Portland, Oregon, and it's not one of the big box kind of, you know, multinational.
Trader Joe's?
It's not Trader Joe's. It's an Oregon-only grocery store, and
we kind of
compete with the Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, but we're a family-owned company, and there's only 10 or 11 of our stores. So I deal with this on a daily basis. You know, just the other day, there was a guy and his son, and I was in the drink aisle, and he even said, "Man, what does the term natural mean?" And that gave me the opportunity to say, the term natural means absolutely nothing at all. Companies can use the word natural and all natural because there's no any kind of federal guidelines. And, of course, regardless of what level that's being, you know, enforced or not, we can at least try and take some faith that the organic logo means 100% organic. So that's what I was able to tell him, that, you know, natural means nothing. It's just like saying, oh,
yeah, they do that in the same, you know, token with guys like Edward Bernays. They do that because it provides an emotional trigger, but it's not real. It's not factual. It's just a hype. You know, it's just a term. It's like natural flavoring. When you see that, folks, that right there is usually something to be suspicious of.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and even some of the better products, you'll still find natural flavors. It's really difficult, and it's one of those things that whether we're talking about food or talking about any of these other areas, there's no easy overnight fix to say, I'm going to, you know, stop doing it, because, you know, unfortunately, so many people in different areas may not have as many choices. I really dig being in Portland, and I've been here for over 5 years now, but it's great being in a place where a lot of local organic food is produced, so you don't have to go too far away. But a lot of other places, you know, don't have that ability. But just as you said, you know, where is this going? What is the end game? What's the next move? When they're building a, you know, vault in Norway in the Arctic and all of these other moves, you would have to stop and say, well, gosh, it seems like they're planning for something, but, you know, what is that something? And you have to follow through and do the research and take the steps to say, oh, these things aren't an accident. There seems to be an agenda behind all of this, and that's what's going to make people hopefully, it's got to come back to local. It's got to come back to more community-based.
I think that's the consensus, and we talked to Cassandra on the show last night. We discussed the idea of growing a garden in all of your friends' backyards. You know, just go to everyone's backyards in your town, and if you plant fruit trees everywhere, if you plant a garden everywhere, not only will people have natural, non-processed, organic food, but we will grow out the Federal Reserve debt-based, slavery-based system, in my eyes. And I know that sounds like it's, you know, selling ourselves short. Like, of course, folks, growing a garden is not the end-all, but it's one step that needs to be done, because we need to take control of our food and our water while we still can. We can't control our air supply anymore, because they're spraying today in the city of Gainesville, Florida, in which I reside. there were trails being sprayed, and I'm saying, oh my gosh, look up in the sky, what on earth are they spraying? And people are looking at me like I'm crazy and I need to go see a psychologist or something, or whatever they think. And then they go watch Dancing with the Stars and have their evening and whatnot. But that's okay. That's the path I choose, and, you know, that's kind of how it works. But, you know, people are concerned about what's going on. I see a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. I meet people like yourself and Paul that really want to do something about it. And there's a lot of great people, I think, that is a 1%, if you will, that can create the peaceful revolution, this revolution of true change. And I'm excited to be alive in these times. I mean, I'm excited.
You're absolutely right. I try not to get, so bogged down and so freaked out. And I think that is something that a lot of folks do, and myself included, that when you get turned on to a lot of this information, you kind of have the mindset that, you know, oh my God, this is all going to go down tomorrow. And you realize, okay, it's probably not going to go down quite that way. It takes you a little while to become a little more measured and see that, you know, yes, this is a slowly unfolding plan.
Yeah, like that frog in a pot of water. It's slowly getting warmer and warmer and warmer until next thing you know, it's boiling. So get ready, folks. You know, this is incrementally happening, but be prepared. Take control. Baby Steps will be back with our special guest, James Evan Pilato. Don't go anywhere. You're listening to the Intel Hub Radio Show. All right, so I started off the show tonight. I called the guy Gary Lambert. And then it turns out his name is George Lambert. And then I'm calling my buddy Paul Verge, Paul Divergent. Like, you know, what's going on here? I can barely get James Evan Pilato out of my mouth. You know, and that's three names, James. You really got me on that one.
I know.
Let me tell you. Anyways, we're back on the Intel Hub Radio Show. My name, let's see if I can get this right, Bob Tuscan, is that right? I think so. All right. Anyways, we're talking about food. We're talking about what we can do. There's so many different things we're talking about. We're kind of having a general discussion with our good friend James Evan Pilato. Why don't you give out the sites one more time, and then we'll jump right back into it.
All right. The flagship site is MediaMonarchy.com, and some of the other sites are Food World Order, Cyberspace War, Holy Hexes, and, of course, NewWorldNextWeek.com for the weekly video series with James Corbett.
Very cool. All right. So, you know, have you gotten a chance, by the way, to get into the Trivium stuff?
Only very slowly. You know, and again, it's been one of those where, like I kind of said that, you know, Richard Grove has been such an inspiration for Media Monarchy from the very beginning. And I kind of felt like throughout the years that I'm always just kind of slowly trying to kind of keep up and being several paces behind. And it's something that, as again, as so many things to do in your life with your work and your relationships and all of the other things, that it is tough to keep up, and just running the website and keeping news posted and doing all those things kind of keep your time occupied. So I guess that's the long and short way of saying not as much as I want to.
Well, it's an interesting topic. It's grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and we've had the pleasure of having Gino Denning on, as well as Jan Irvin and many others, to discuss this. And we'll talk a little bit more about it with Paul Verge, because I know he has gotten into it, specifically the logical fallacies, which is an absolutely fascinating thing. And he did a little comedy blurb. I don't know, did you see this, where he had this pop-up logical? No, that was Jan. He did, what was the one I liked? He did logical fallacy spray. Did you see that one?
Does it run as sort of a commercial?
Yeah, it's kind of a parody, and he mentions all the logical fallacies. It's real good. I'll post that on my Facebook, and maybe we'll put that up at the IntelHubRadio.com, so check that out. Hey, by the way, did you hear we made the Southern Poverty Law Center's list?
I did, you know, and I meant to make the note that the first thing I was going to say when I came on the air was, hey, you know, I don't know, when I agreed to do this show, I didn't know you guys were on the SPLC's list.
Well, that makes it even better. We're getting congratulations all over the chat room. Let me read some of the comments here. Congratulations, Intel Hub. You made the SPLC list. That's very cool. What a bunch of carpet-bagging hate mongers they are. Am I allowed to say that on radio? I hope so. they also say, nice, means you are on target. Frankly, I am jealous. Keep on rocking the free world, somebody writes here. Let's see here. We say, Ernest says, congratulations on being listed by the SPLC. I never realized that we would get so many congratulations for being on the Southern Poverty Law Center's recently released their Active Patriots group for 2010, which is supposed to put legitimate news outlets and groups in the same category as racist white nationalist. You know, how dare us talk about 9/11 truth or whatever. There's other groups on there. You know some of them, I'm sure. And obviously this isn't anything new with the SPLC. They've released a lot of ridiculous reports over the years, including Oath Keepers and a lot of other groups that you probably are familiar with. And they say that we stand for groundless conspiracy theories. Here's quoted from their own website. By the way, this article is up at theintelhub.com. The intelligence project identified 824 anti-government, quote, patriot groups that were active in 2010. Of these groups, 330 of them were militias, marked with an asterisk, and the remainder includes common law courts, publishers, ministries, and citizen groups. Generally, patriot groups define themselves as opposed to the New World Order, engaged in groundless conspiracy theorizing and advocate or adhere to extreme anti-government doctrines. Let's see, James, are you in that picture there? Does that describe you?
I suppose it does. I guess, you know, when I checked out that article and the list of all the groups, you know, there was the mix of, you know, just looking for anything I was associated with on the list, and I guess the mix of relief or disappointment. But, you know, this is a part of just, you know, the foundation-funded, you know, quote-unquote independent organizations that are the mouthpiece for, you know, it goes up the pyramid, if you will, CFR and all of these other kind of foundation-funded media matters and anti-hate groups that they kind of set the agenda to all the other folks who will then, you know, listen to National Petroleum Radio and really think they're really informed. And so tomorrow they can talk at the water cooler about, you hear all those hate groups. And of course they'll just try and paint it with a broad brush and say, oh, it's Tea Party. Oh, it's Glenn Beck, or, oh, it's that crazy guy Charlie Sheen was talking to, you know, it's garbage.
That's Alex Jones' new title.
What's that?
The crazy guy, Alex Jones, that crazy conspiracy guy. And I was reading that, what was it? I don't know. Let's talk about something else. Jeez, why does he come up?
Sorry.
Get him out of here.
Sorry, I did it. Well, you know, something, one thing I was going to mention in the first segment, I was going to give you a mention, kind of the sneak preview of what we've got coming up on the next episode of New World next week. Where, I don't know if you saw, just, I believe it was Sunday, the Associated Press put out a pretty large report about past medical experiments being uncovered.
I did see that. Tell us more.
So we cover that story, and again, it's one of those where we pretty much know so many of these stories, and so many of them, if we, you know, may not know every single bit of info, this is just another kind of mainstream confirmation of things we already knew. So whether that's last year's, you know, admission of Guatemalan syphilis experiments going all the way back to the Tuskegee syphilis experiments and all of these things that, again, go back to probably intelligence and foundation funded, quote unquote, hospitals to do their work and quote unquote research. And then they'll paint them and put them in mass media entertainment, whether, you know, Shutter Island or things like that. And you think, oh, you know, well, that couldn't actually be real. The other couple of stories we go over is actually a New Zealand ag research outlet actually stopped their cloning experiments because all of the animals somehow get sick and die, and it just isn't working out. But they're going to continue to barrel on with their GMO and transgenic technology experiments. And the third story we cover is something off of Cryptogon.com, where he posted up some correspondence he had with the executive producer of a conspiracy theory TV show that shall remain slightly nameless. And the guy
Conspiracy theory?
He doesn't come out and say that's what it is, but it's that's what it is. But the executive producer wrote him and said, hey, we're a fan of Cryptogon. Do you have any ideas of things we should cover on the show? And after one or two back and forth, apparently the guy wouldn't even talk to him anymore.
Ah, what do you think he told him to cover?
He kind of lays it out on the website and shows him he talked about, of course, well, let's talk about CIA drug running. Let's talk about the eugenics agenda. Let's talk about the Federal Reserve. Let's talk
about HIV/AIDS. You know, that's an interesting topic. We have Tommy Morrison, former heavyweight champion, on our radio show, Liam Sheff, The Investigation. There's an article at the Intel Hub coming out about the HIV/AIDS fraud. That's one of many topics that we should talk about. Let's see here, folks. We're coming up to the end of the hour, and next hour we'll be joined with Paul of the Verge family. And we'll keep James Evan Pilato with us for a little bit longer, do a little bit of a crossover segment. I know you guys know each other and work with each other sometimes. Why don't you give out the websites one last time, James, for this hour, and then we'll move to the next hour, and we'll talk about a lot of great stuff with Paul Verge. Not going to miss that. Let's see here. We have 20 seconds. Go ahead with those sites.
All right. MediaMonarchy.com is the flagship site, but then there's FoodWorldOrder.com, CyberspaceWar.com, HolyHexes.com, and NewWorldNextWeek.com.
And the IntelHubRadio.com. All right, folks, stay tuned. This is OracleBroadcasting.com. Live Free or Die with Lee Rogers, of course, coming up after this program. And stay tuned to all the great shows on Oracle Broadcasting and support the network. Donate those Federal Reserve notes if you can. It helps. Anyways, I'm Bob Paskin. I'm Bob Paskin. See, I can't even say my own name tonight. That proves it. I'm Bob Tuskin. All right, folks. Hour number two of the program. I'm Bob Tuskin. Shep's feeling a little bit under the weather. Let's jump right back into it. James Evan Pilato joining us, along now with Paul Verge of Divergent Films. Paul, welcome. You guys are getting a chance to speak for the first time, although you guys have worked together and collaborated and obviously both contribute to Tragedy and Hope and a lot of great stuff. This is a chance for you guys to meet each other officially and talk on air, which is kind of cool. So say hello.
Howdy, James.
How you doing, man? This, you know, and this is, I think, what's so fantastic about the technology and about the opportunities that we have right now is this amazing way that we can bring people together.
That's right.
Absolutely. And it's cool because James is a fellow West Coaster, so we're on the same vibe, kind of, you know, all of us working our day job and then spending our extra time trying to put information out there that empowers and educates people. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's absolutely right. And the Intel Hub, of course, is based in the Northwest, so we have that vibe going. And they actually found our secret headquarters for that Southern Poverty Law Center article we were telling you about, which is kind of creepy. I wonder how they found that.
Yeah, I mean, those guys, their whole job is to basically create a somewhat, well, they're not really credible, actually, if you look into their history. But their whole job is to create smear campaigns that other media sources can then reference. And if you look at their arguments, even a lot of the arguments against the supremacist groups and stuff, they're mostly fallacious, mostly fallacy-based arguments. So, you know, you can consider it a badge of honor to be labeled by them. I know We Are Change is on their list as well, and I'm friends with Luke Radowski and absolutely not an extremist by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, if you can get on their list, then it must mean you're doing something to influence people. Otherwise, they wouldn't mention your name.
Yeah, we're wearing it as a badge of honor. It's not the worst thing. So there's a lot of things that we should talk about. James, have you been following what's going on in the Middle East at all?
You know, I have, but in such a strange way, again, with all of the technology, that on the one hand you feel so instantly connected to what's going on around the world, but you also feel so completely detached from it. And that until it's really, you know, smacking you in the face here, for the most part it's like, hey, you know, my power still works and I've got some food and the internet's up and things seem okay. And that's a bizarre feeling. But have I been in following it? Absolutely. every bit of minutia, you know, there's just no time to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff to follow. I heard today that people are accusing the government psyops of going on Twitter and stirring up things there. And we talked about the CFR connection to some of this. And it's interesting. You know, I keep an open mind. And in the news a couple weeks ago, we had Israel dropping bombs on the Palestinian settlements there. I don't think I get to speak about that enough. I'm actually missing out on talking with Alan Dershowitz. I don't know if you guys know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
He's at the University of Florida right now. I'm missing that so that I can be with you guys. I would love to confront him. Anyways, here
well,
we are.
I was going to say thank you for being here with us, but hope you know, hopefully somebody is confronting him.
They need to. And you know who did? Not Leonard Horowitz. Finkelstein.
Norm Finkelstein.
He confronted him. That was a great conversation. Check that out. If you Google Norm Finkelstein, Alan Dershowitz. All right, we'll be back in just a moment with Paul Verge and James Evan Palazzo. Don't go anywhere, folks. This is the Intel Hub Radio on OracleBroadcasting.com. Welcome back to the Intel Hub Radio Show. I'm your host, Bob Tuscan. Our website, theintelhubradio.com. You can see all of our past guests and upcoming shows there. We're joined with Paul Verge of the Verge family, and as well as Paul Verge, we'll join now with our special guest, James Evan Palazzo, and we're talking about, I don't know, we're talking about everything. There's so many things to talk about that I don't like to limit ourselves based on topics, and I know that might get a little scattered, but I think all of these things connect, and there's, you know, a big picture here that we have to look at, and we can't just focus on one aspect of it, because then we'll get tunnel vision, and that's never good. One of the things that we talked about during the break, James and Paul, is this idea that we need to put out a resource for people to be able to navigate Netflix, which could actually be a tool, in my eyes. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Paul, you want to take it?
Well, I think the idea of navigating Netflix is there's a lot of great films out there that offer a lot of information, but offering the information within context of other films and other work isn't necessarily provided for people. So what James and myself and Richard Grove and several others wanted to do was essentially watch a film and then gather together on a Skype call or something and record our conversation, kind of elucidating upon the film and offering, you know, references and context and a lot of other things, so that people can get a fuller understanding of a film that they might watch on Netflix.
Interesting. And that includes telling people, you know, which films to find that they might not necessarily find on Netflix. I've been able to find a lot of fascinating flicks on Netflix, including The House of Numbers. Have you guys been able to see that one yet?
Do they have that on Netflix?
They have that on Netflix. It's the documentary about the HIV/AIDS fraud, and it's an absolutely fascinating documentary. And that, as well as I saw a cool documentary with Ram Dass.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know Ram Dass, right? Be Here Now?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That was a really cool documentary. There's a lot of documentaries that I want to share with you know, like-minded individuals such as, you know, yourselves. And this is a great idea, navigating Netflix. There's also films to stay away from in my mind, you know, films that are based on, I don't know, logical fallacies and just a lack of research. I think we should look at everything with an open mind, but that being said, I think we should avoid some of the films that are not going to, I don't know, maybe I'm missing something here. Paul, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, there's a tendency for people to hear other people's opinions, and they might say stay away, or this person, you know, worships the devil, or whatever the case may be. But a lot of time that could be shooting the messenger. And I find even the stuff that I don't agree with, I still like to consume somewhat, and it's a good exercise in critical thinking, especially something that is rich in fallacies. Then it's almost like an exercise for your mind, because, you know, you can watch a film from like 1934, like The House of Rothschild, which won the Academy Award. You know, if you have the contextual history of the Rothschild family, you can see what a brilliant piece of propaganda this film is. But, you know, if you don't, you know, you might watch it and, you know, believe, oh, wow, these Rothschild people were really benevolent. That's great. So I wouldn't avoid watching that film because it's propaganda, but it's interesting as a reflection of the kind of art as propaganda or art imitating life as propaganda.
That's right. That's what I was trying to say.
But exactly. I think James has some good recommendations for Netflix as well.
Well, and I was going to say that, you know, this started out navigating Netflix is just one of the many groups that you can find in the tragedyandhope.com community. And as I started to look at it and I started to add a couple of suggestions to the group, for whatever reason, the lightning bolt hit and I was like, oh my God, I would love to do a show based around this. I come from college radio. I'm a huge film and music and media fan, and it's the thing I always kind of come back to. And for me, isn't it always ironic that, you know, the news is the thing that's supposed to tell us the truth, but it is half truths and sometimes lies. And then the arts are supposed to be make believe, but somehow there are more truths to be found within those stories.
Totally. And I was just going to say that it's funny, you know, if a lot of people watch documentaries to get their sort of facts and perspectives and everything. But I think one of the most interesting experiments with the navigating Netflix idea will be to watch, you know, non-documentaries and examine the symbolism and, you know, the hidden kind of messages, movies like The Matrix. Maybe, yeah, I think that's been overanalyzed, but there's
Wizard
a lot of other
Oz.
Movies. Yeah, Wizard of Oz, V for Vendetta. You can analyze these movies to look at not just the storyline they're presenting, but like the deeper context and the deeper,
yeah.
There's a lot of symbolism, you know what I mean? Especially in great films, right? You can watch Citizen Kane, and if you know about William Randolph Hearst, that's a really, really interesting movie.
Didn't they put 9/11 in a lot of films on the clocks and in random places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen YouTube videos looking into that, but
you think that's just a coincidence?
Well, I mean, 9-1-1 has been in the public consciousness since the emergency number kind of was created back in the day, right? So, if you look into numerology, there is some occult significance to those numbers, but I think we can go towards the tendency of kind of sliding past critical thinking and applying meaning to every single instance of 9/11 we come across, whereas the law of averages says there's going to be some coincidences, even though it's like who's to determine, you know?
How about this? For a crazy coincidence, I had a listener call up the other day and say that if you add how old you're going to be next year with the year you were born, the last two numbers of that year. So I was born in 86. I'm going to be 25. 86 plus 25 equals 111. And everyone alive will get that number. How creepy is that?
I heard that from my good friend Clyde Lewis of groundzeromedia.org. I heard him mention that on his show, and yeah, I did it myself. I was like, oh my God, it does.
You get 111? How about you, Paul? You get 111?
Absolutely. I actually did the math, and it's kind of one of those neat math tricks. Like if you multiply 11 by any two-digit number, you just add the two numbers together, put it in the middle, and that's the answer, right? So 11 is one of those weird numbers. You know, in occult symbology, it means the beginning and the end. And it's one of those weird numbers that just has all these, you know, quote-unquote magical mathematical properties. But that's a part of the quadrivium. So, you know, that's definitely a subject for a whole other show.
I would just also kind of quickly throw in here and mention back to the navigating Netflix idea and the documentaries versus narratives. I had a guy, you know, email me and kind of, it was funny, he even asked the question, hey, do you have any ideas of things that I should watch on Netflix? It's like, funny you should ask. We're working on a show just, you know, about that. And after I sent him probably four documentary ideas and four narrative film ideas, I looked and realized that the documentaries were actually kind of more entertainment-y based, and the feature films and the narratives were actually had a lot more social
content. Exactly. Interesting. Hey, we're coming up to our last break. Media Monarchy is his website. James Evan Palazzo, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, thank you. My pleasure.
All right, folks, don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more. This is the Intel Hub Radio Show. I'm your host, Bob Tuscan. Chef's feeling a little bit under the weather. We'll be back with Paul Verge. We're joined with Paul Verge. You're listening to the Intel Hub Radio Show. I'm Bob Tuscan. We're talking about learning. We're talking about Tragedy and Hope, a site that features this kind of learning. And, you know, it's all about being open-minded. It's all about critical thinking. These are all things that I know, Paul, you look at a lot. But why don't you tell the listeners a little bit more about yourself and how you got started? And was 9/11 the main thing for you, or does it go back further?
Well, actually, it's interesting you mentioned that, and we'll bring it full circle because you had that intro with David Icke speaking. But after 9/11, I kind of got interested in the dichotomy between these different Muslim groups, because, you know, part of my family is Muslim, and they were telling me, you know, that not all Muslims get along. There's these different groups, and I saw the media pushing Bin Laden and Saddam Hussein as like buddies, and I was like, that doesn't make any sense. So my brother lent me a David Icke book, and when I had crossed the border to go from Canada to the United States, as I chronicle in Hijacking Humanity, my one of my films, the border guards seized the book and held me for 2 hours for questioning, and you know, this book that I wasn't really going to take very seriously on 9/11, I ended up reading and fact-checking and trying to verify as much as I could to try and prove it wrong. And it ended up being more and more correct. So I started reading David Icke's work, which led to, you know, a whole host of other researchers, authors, filmmakers. And I decided to try and make some of my own films, started associating with groups in Vancouver, like thinkfree.ca. And, you know, once I went to New York in 2006 for the September 11th conference, and I met some really cool people like Luke and Dylan Avery and others, that kind of solidified the idea of making a film like Hijacking Humanity, which is meant to cross-pollinate all these different ideas from, you know, Bernaysian propaganda to the banking cartels to commerce and law and the whole legal personhood thing to false flag terrorism like 9/11, and put it all in one film. And it's all branched out from there, because through making that film, I met guys like Richard Grove, Jan Urban, Henry Macau, Maria Heller and many others, and was able to actually get an interview with David Icke himself for my new film series, Believers Beware. So it's, you know, since I started about 5 years ago, it's been a progression, but I've watched my education increase, my, you know, amount of learning increase, and I've more than anything realized how much I don't know, how much there is still to learn. So it keeps me hopefully in a mode of humility where I don't just, you know, outright dismiss new ideas. I try and investigate them impartially and give them some weight of critical thinking.
Well, that's the art of a good thinker, is somebody who understands that they do not know. You know, they know that they do not know. I think that's one of the famous philosophers said that, you know, and there's so many things out there that we need to keep an open mind about that on the surface may seem one way, but on closer inspection may be totally different. And if any of us close our minds, I think, you know, it's said best with Robert Anton Wilson's work, The Cosmic Trigger. You know, the belief, a belief, the second you say, I believe this, that's the destruction of any further thought. That puts yourself in a box. And I get out of all those boxes just like you do, Paul. And one of the great sites helping people learning the skills to get out of those boxes that you're featured at as a contributor, along with our previous guests, James Evan Pilato and James Corbett, as well as John Irvin, a good friend of ours. It's Tragedy and Hope. Tragedy and Hope just put out a new video giving a synopsis of what it's all about, where Richard Grove talks about all the different features, the premises of Tragedy and Hope, how it got its name from the Carol Quigley book, and on and on and on. Paul, tell us more about this amazing project.
Well, back in not long after Hijacking Humanity came out, Richard and Lisa, his fiance, had been nurturing this idea of trying to create either an online magazine or a kind of community that we could attract more and more artists and researchers and people like James and Maria Heller and Brett Bonnot and Jan Urban and others to kind of unify under our common ground, our common messages. We all have, you know, differing ideas and beliefs that we subscribe to, but we agree on so much common ground that we decided it would be like, you know, forming a chorus of singers as opposed to trying to sing by ourselves. And the result has been nothing short of amazing. In the last few years, we've watched our community grow, and all really good quality people who come in for, you know, fear-free, logical discussions, you know, they're quote-unquote subscribed to a higher awareness in terms of, they're not seeking to go out and troll sites. They're going to seeking real learning, a real education, as opposed to just kind of being spoon-fed what to think. They appreciate that Tragedy and Hope is trying to show you how to think properly, how to think critically using this ordered methodology called
the Tribune. You know, be an autodidact. What's the word?
Autodidact. An autodidactic learner means somebody who learns for themselves, who is able to self-learn. So essentially an autodidact could teach themselves auto mechanics or how to fix a computer by going through the steps and logically following the grammar. And then they could actually, once they've mastered that skill, they could use their rhetoric then to teach someone else that skill. So the Trivium in that regard is a very useful tool in not only critically thinking and identifying logical fallacies, but in helping you become autodidactic so that you can teach yourself anything that you want. And that removes a huge layer of uncertainty from our lives, because one of the things we come across is our dependencies. We depend on so many other people, and there's a lot of conveniences offered to make us lose our independency. And when you have the Trivium, you actually gain a lot of your independency back, because you're no longer afraid of the unknown.
It gives you a self-esteem, you know. It gives you this control, if you will, you know, not in a negative way, but in a way in which it empowers you with the tools of thinking. And we'll be having more shows on this topic. But one of the main points of the Trivium that people need to look at is critical thinking and inductive versus deductive reasoning. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, I think everybody's born with a kind of version of inductive critical thinking. That's where, you know, if you burn your hand on a plate when you're 2 years old, you're probably going to remember not to touch that plate again.
Yeah, man, that hurts.
You've learned. And so that's kind of built into all of us as human beings, which, thank goodness, you know. Whereas the deductive version is something that people develop an understanding of more around the age of puberty, as Gino Denning's talked about, understanding this trivium-based method of critical thinking, which is essentially analyzing the grammar, using the logic to remove all contradictions, and then using the art of rhetoric to communicate the idea that you've now gained, you know, logic and understanding from. So if you're to go forward and apply this methodology of critical thinking that is complementary to your inductive version of critical thinking that we all have, then what it is like a super virus scanner for your mind. So when you're watching the news or you're getting afflicted by corporate advertising, it no longer is able to burrow itself into your subconscious mind as effectively, because you've now got this kind of filter that allows that stuff to be, you know, discarded in the trash bin of your mind.
And your mind is like a computer, if you will. It's constantly uploading information. And if you upload information that you take for granted, if you allow the programming of the mainstream media to consume your thoughts, then of course, folks, you're going to be brainwashed into thinking that war is good or whatever it may be, that the chemtrails are normal. It goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. They're putting fluoride in our water supply. There's so many things to talk about. When we come back after this quick break, we'll be back with Paul Verge and more on the Intel Hub Radio Show. I'm your host, Bob Tuscan. The website, theintelhubradio.com and theintelhub.com. Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back. The Intel Hub Radio Show. Bob Tuscan and Paul Verge talking about education, talking about critical thinking, talking about having the tools in these serious times to deal with whatever comes down the road. And Paul, intellectual defensism? What were you telling me?
Intellectual self-defense.
Intellectual self-defense. Say that five times fast.
Totally. And it's essentially, you know, we teach ourselves all these different defensive kind of maneuvers, whether it's, you know, martial arts or whatever. But for our mind, a lot of times we just kind of take in everything and we don't really apply that high standard of critical thinking. And, you know, in the end, that's all that deception going unchecked is what causes the majority of the problems in the world. So if you can arm yourself with a form of intellectual self-defense, like the trivium-based method of critical thinking, you can go out into the world and, you know, not be deceived, be certain of your decisions, and find that satisfaction that you're looking for, you know, because we can externalize all the problems. There is this giant elitist hierarchy trying to, you know, enslave us, but ultimately that is only happening because we haven't done enough to stop that flow from happening. So the real change starts from us first, within ourselves, to educate ourselves, to learn how to effectively educate others, And then when enough people know what's going on, we just all stop giving our power and our energy to the system that's abusing us.
A lot of us have been robbed by that system, and it starts with our education system. The Prussian education system sort of gives people this compulsory, you know, education in which they're just told to repeat something and that's the right answer, and then they test, implying that everyone's equal. There's a lot of things we can talk about when it comes to education that I know both of us are very interested in, and I know a lot of our listeners are interested in. And you work at times with the School Sucks podcast. What a great podcast that is, right?
Yeah, Brett Vinott, you know, I came to it through Richard and Jan were fans, and also through Stefan Molyneux's Free Domain Radio. But yeah, the School Sucks podcast, man, Brett articulates, you know, what's wrong with the, not just the education system, but how just our viewpoints towards children and youth in general is really, you know, one of the major causes of how we imprint all this negative conditioning onto this next generation and then wonder why there's such conflicts, you know what I mean? So I would definitely recommend people check out his podcast, Brett Vinott's School Sucks podcast.
And check out that valedictorian talk that that girl gave. How cool was that?
Yeah, Erica Goldson. She is really cool, and especially for someone so young, she's learned a lot of great wisdom in such a short time, and she was brave enough to share it with everyone, you know?
Well, this has nothing to do with age. The kids that learn the Trivium, they get this stuff. This is something that I think transcends age. It has to do with the mind, and you know, this is something that is another example of how people from all spectrums of life seek enlightenment, if you will.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, right? Like you said, age doesn't really matter, and I think it's really that Erica was able to select the right books to read to get some perspectives that were a little outside the mainstream, but that, you know, she's very clearly an educated speaker and someone who knew what she was talking about in terms of the experience she had just gone through with high school and that kind of form of education, compulsory. So, you know, I'm glad that her video, the valedictorian speech, has gotten so much publicity, because it needs to not only get there to show older people that the youth are thinking, but to also show the other youth that thinking is cool, that, you can read books and think about things deeply, not just shallowly, and it's actually cool to do that.
But thinking is not cool, Paul, because the guy that asked Penn and Teller about Building 7, well, we should chant tase him, because he's making us think about a subject matter that's not Dancing with the Stars or, you know, the Jersey Shore.
Well, yeah, the idea of groupthink is, you know, it's pernicious and it continues. And, you know, one person trying to educate a crowd, it's a thin line between them being with you and them wanting to go after you. So all you can do is learn to, you know, the art of persuasion.
The art of persuasive thinking, the art of, you know, what's really going on. There's the Quadrivium, which talks about the arts a bit. Paul, are you with us? Did you drop? Yeah, I think you did drop. Well, that's quite all right, folks, because there's plenty to talk about. And we will take calls with Paul for the last segment of tonight's program. So you can call us at the Oracle Broadcasting call-in line at 1-866-841-1065. Get out your crayon, write this down. That's 866-841-1065. And we're talking with Paul Burge of Divergent Films. We're talking a little bit about the Trivium, the education system. And as always, we're interested in hearing your thoughts about what solutions we have, Paul. You know, everybody wants to talk about the problems with the education system or with our government or geopolitics, you know, but not everybody wants to talk about what we can do about it. And usually that's the sign in my eyes of somebody who's a real person who's doing this for more than just fear and hype, and somebody who is interested in just doing this for the fame or the, you know, propaganda. What are your real motives in presenting this information? That's what we have to ask ourselves. You know, what are the people's true intentions when they present this stuff? Are people interested in presenting these ideas for the sake of the ideas? Or are we, you know, obsessed with the Charlie Sheen celebrity mentality and, you know, the, you know, aesthetics and the messenger You know, that's one of the number one fallacies, Paul, is to go after the messenger, right?
Absolutely. And sorry I dropped out there for a second.
Not a problem.
Yeah, I mean, if I can make a point about Charlie Sheen, because I've seen a lot of perspectives kind of being put out there.
All right, and, here we go. Controversial, folks. This is what our listeners like. This will get the ratings up. Paul Burge on Charlie Sheen. Here we go. Here's a YouTube clip. And action.
Okay, well, think about the possibility that Charlie Sheen and his other representative right now, which is AJ from Infowars.com.
Who's that?
That Alex Jones.
I'm just joking. Okay. Get him off my show. Why does he keep coming up?
He's one of those presences that you just can't deny exists. But to make a point, those guys are both really good at getting PR. Like, they know what buttons to push in order to get any kind of coverage. And I would point to the story of Macbeth from Shakespeare, where Macbeth, or is it Macbeth or Hamlet? I'm going to get confused here. But where the character pretends to be insane in order to, you know, throw off the authorities, who think that if he knows what's going on, they're going to go after him. So entertain the idea that Charlie Sheen may very well be on, you know, manic or crazy or whatever, but also entertain the idea that he may be giving the performance of his lifetime so that he's able to not only get all this publicity, but to get a whole bunch of ideas out there that are controversial that normally he wouldn't be able to say if they were considering him as quote-unquote sane. Whereas when he's already got this label on him as insane, he can go out and say whatever he wants, including some truth.
Is that a good thing, though? Do we want people to associate these ideas with crazy people?
No, definitely not. And I think that's the one negative side of the coin, is that, you know, if he says enough negative things and, you know, people employ the guilt by association fallacy, then yes, I can see where someone could be like, oh, you're a 9/11 truther, just like crazy Charlie Sheen, and then dismiss you. But then that person would be identifying that they're using fallacy tactics, and that gives you the opportunity to call them out on that and try and bring more substance to their argument as opposed to just dismissing you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in that regard, it's like, I'm proud to say that I'm watching the whole Charlie Sheen thing with a smile on my face, because even if he is coming from a place where he's really unhealthy, it's almost like the dude in Network who just finally blows a cork and he just decides to just shout out the truth as he sees it, no matter what the cost is. And, you know, he's mad as hell and he's not going to take it anymore. And that ignites this firestorm of righteous indignation amongst people. So, you know, I've never seen Alex Jones on The View before, and because of the Charlie Sheen thing, he's on there, you know, explaining all this stuff, which is going to bring in this other mainstream audience to this information.
That's true. And did you see that on one of the websites, they took out the word Building 7. They made it sound like he was saying they just blow up buildings, and they took out the 7 part. And, you know, yeah. I agree. When I confronted Penn and Teller, you know, that might not have been as great as I would have wanted it to be, granted that I had to force my question in there as I was being heckled and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the idea that Penn and Teller, or Penn, went on his Facebook and his Twitter account talking about Building 7 afterwards to over a million plus followers of his, sheeple of his, mm-hmm. that at least hopefully opened the doorway for them to go watch the footage of Building 7. So piercing through the veil is important, and we do have to branch beyond the choir. You know, preaching to the choir is something that I think we need to get beyond. And let's talk a little bit more about that after this last break of the show. Paul, time flies. Let's be here now in the moment, and we'll be back in just a moment on the other side of this break. You're listening to the Intel Hub Radio Show on Oracle Broadcasting. Alrighty, final segment, the Intel Hub Radio Show. And we're talking with Paul Verge of Divergent Films and the Verge family. And we're talking about Charlie Sheen. We brought him up. Yeah, I know. Jeez, I know you're probably sick of it like I am. But, you know, it's important that we plant seeds. And, Paul, why don't we elaborate a little bit on this analogy?
Yeah, well, to transition from Charlie Sheen, essentially, even if he's is crazy, he's still, through his rants, is planting some seeds in the minds of people who wouldn't ordinarily come across a lot of this information. So I think that's the most responsible thing we can do. You know, as we're educating ourselves and we still want to share information, even though we haven't fully educated ourselves, no one knows, you know, everything that's going on, but we still want to communicate what we think we know. And so planting seeds of smaller ideas, not necessarily forcing someone to try and see the whole big picture all at once, which can be mm-hmm. overwhelming to people.
Well, you got to start somewhere. And exactly. Here's the thing, though, all right? And I'm going to tell you about something that happened to me. At the water fountain the other day, I was drinking some water because I forgot my fluoride-free water. So I went to the water fountain. I was exercising. Got to stay hydrated. So a little fluoride, I guess, is
good for
well
your teeth,
worth
right?
it. Yeah, right? So anyways, the guy next to me at the water fountain, I say, what do you think about this fluoride in our water? He looks at me and he says, it's good for you. Mm-hmm. I said, well, what is your source on that? Why do you say that? He says, look, buddy, leave me alone. And he takes this tone, like he's offended that I even say anything. How dare you talk about my water being poisoned? How dare you tell me we're both being poisoned as we drink some water and try to enjoy some exercise, okay? And then he proceeds to, heighten up his tone with me and, threatens me and says, eh, screw you, and, he goes on and on. So the point is that if you can't even talk to your neighbors and plant a seed about an issue like fluoride, no wonder you can't talk about 9/11 and that creates such an emotional response. No wonder you can't talk about any of these things. So it's almost like, what baby steps do we need to give people? What seeds do we need to plant in which these people are going to break free from their conditioning? It's got to start somewhere. It's the troubling thing is, what issue is the best issue to do that with? I don't know, and I don't know if anybody else does as well.
Well, I think that you can find a relevance to a certain situation, right? Like, if you happen to be talking about terrorism, then you could bring up the idea of false flags and just, you don't have to make impart of your position necessarily. As ask other people what their positions are and kind of get a flavor for where people are at in terms of their education. And then you'll know what seed in your arsenal to try and plant, right? And, there's a thing about planting seeds. You don't just, drop a seed, kick some dirt on it, and walk away. You've got to water it from time to time. You got to make sure you dig into the soil a bit. And don't just leave it on the surface, but plant it in a deeper way.
And how about this for an analogy? It has to be the right season.
Well, that's true. I think, people, if somebody is already annoyed with something and you try and bring up something that's going to challenge their paradigm, like this gentleman who was at the water fountain with mm-hmm. you, on another day, he might be more receptive to that information. But in that day where he had been working out or whatever, and he's just at the water fountain, it'd be like if somebody, you're at a urinal or something, and somebody's like, so how about that 9/11 and that Bin Laden? I guess you could have a conversation there, but it might feel a little awkward, right? So like you said, timing is everything, and then, knowing which seed to plant, how far down to plant it. But the key thing is once you do plant that seed, it's there. It's embedded in that person, and you don't know who going to come along later on and water it. They might even water it unknowingly. And I,
good point.
Hundreds of people that I've talked with at the beginning of my journey, I've watched them come around. And not all of them come around at the same pace or the same time, but it's something in their own life that they come across, some piece of media that they see in the right context. Suddenly all the seeds that I've planted throughout the years suddenly start blooming at different times,
I've
and
seen
it comes
that
back
as well.
To me.
Isn't that
so
amazing?
It's encouraging as heck, man.
They come back to me and they say, hey, Bob, hey, Paul, that thing you said about the Federal Reserve, hey, I've been thinking about it. And you're like, wow, man. And it gives you this sense of, feeling intuitively that you're on the right path and that, when other people start to see this, it makes you feel good. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah, I describe it as, spiritually fulfilling in that you're trying to raise each other's consciousness. You're trying to raise each other's vibration, I guess you could say. And through proper education that's not based on fear but based on empowerment, you can do that. You're essentially infecting other people with consciousness and trying to get them to a higher place of understanding. Because once we get to a place where we're communicating in a conscious and nonviolent way, we're going to make so much progress. It's the root cause of all these conflicts is the way we communicate with each other is domination based. It's mostly mm-hmm. conflictual. We're competing with each other. We're always trying to communicate with our judgments and our prejudices. And because of that, it doesn't allow a lot of progress to get, made because we're stuck in that kind of status quo.
I'm glad you brought that up. Let's talk about nonviolent communication for a little bit. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I recently was able to watch Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication videos on YouTube, which there's an abundance of them for free. And we actually did an episode of the Peace Revolution podcast where Richard Grove, Lisa Arbuchowski, myself, and one of my business partners, Robert Christie, we talked about nonviolent communication. And the idea is this. You're trying to get at the root of somebody's needs and their feelings, and letting go of the judgments and all the baggage that you have attached to someone or some idea, so that in communicating with them, you can identify each other's needs, each other's feelings around those needs, and actually try and fulfill those needs for each other without, it's about finding win-win scenarios as opposed to the status quo, which states for every person who wins, someone must lose. And so it requires you to communicate a little more creatively and a little less judgmentally, but the end result is the person you're talking to actually listens to what you're saying. It's an amazing thing, because you're trying to communicate what you think their needs and feelings are, and then suddenly they're like, hey, you're putting yourself in my shoes. I appreciate that, so now I'm going to try and put myself in your shoes. And then you appreciate that, and then look what you've got. You've got this dialogue going where, you know, 5 minutes ago you hated each other, and now you're actually listening to each other.
I need to learn how to do this. Everybody tells me I'm an abrasive, angry, crazy conspiracy guy. I need to learn about this.
Well, it's just one of the aspects of, you know, proper rhetoric. I think it's important to note that the word rhetoric is usually said in a negative connotation, but all rhetoric really means is to communicate, to have the wisdom to communicate. And so there's deceptive rhetoric, which is, you know, that's the politicians and the CEOs and the news media. And then there's persuasive positive rhetoric, where, you know, you're communicating an idea clearly without offending somebody's sensibilities, and they're actually listening and hearing what you're saying and applying their critical thinking to it. So I think, you know, when we're trying to communicate these big ideas, these conspiratorial ideas, to find the best way to plant a seed without it being rejected is to use nonviolent communication.
And don't forget fallacy be gone spray.
Yeah, I posted a link there for you in Skype, so you can put that up if you want. But that fallacy be gone commercial I did for What You've Been Missing, episode one, exposing the noble lie, which you can find on YouTube if you just type in WYBM. Or if you go to tragedyandhope.com, you can see What You've Been Missing there.
First episode I think I've ever seen of a new series, and there's more to come. All right, let's take a quick call, Paul. We have a caller on the line. Area code 408. Real quick, what's your question or comment for Paul Verge?
Hey, yeah, this is Joey, and I'm calling about anytime you mention about consciousness or DMT or any of that stuff, people immediately think, oh, New Age movement or something. That's an idea of the Illuminati or the Freemasons or something. Could you comment on that or something?
Okay, yeah, no problem, sir. Stand by real quick on entheogens. We talk a little bit about that on Truth Frequency Radio, another show. It's something that's something we should look at, right, Paul? But with the tools of the trivium and logic, because you can't do it from a place, I think, of, you know, naivety or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the idea of consciousness and psychedelics and entheogens, they kind of tie together, because there's this whole notion that, you know, we're these conscious beings who have the potential for a higher or deeper understanding of how things work. And having tried entheogens myself, I can honestly attest firsthand that it does take you into an altered state of consciousness where you see things completely differently, but not in a negative way. You come to a lot of realizations. You realize you have this thing called an ego, and you experience what's called ego death, where your consciousness
ego,
kind of melts away.
Ego be gone spray.
Ego be gone, exactly.
Hey, Paul Verge, it's been a great program. Thanks so much. Why don't you give out your links real quick?
Yeah, tragedyandhope.com, hijackinghumanity.com, divergentfilms.com, and thinkfree.ca. And I would just say, investigate things that you're told are occultist, and investigate things that you're told not to look at, and do it with an open mind, objectively, non-judgmentally.
Well, the definition of occult is hidden, and we should put light on all of these hidden topics. And I thank you for doing that. Folks, this has been the Intel Hub Radio Show. We'll see you tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned, Oracle Broadcasting. Lee Rogers coming up next.